welcome to the CWF Gamecast, deceased estate fans. I'm Tom Barbalay, and today I'm joined by my giggling co-host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Hello, Jonathan.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Very good, very good. So this week, we actually have a little section on deceased estates sponsored by the What Would Pan Do News from the Front podcast.
Luke Miller
Pardon?
Luke Millia, in particular.
In particular, yes. Yeah, but I think the whole clan deserves an update associated with deceased estates. You want to talk about the recent podcast problems, the mailbag. We had numerous bits and pieces of our mutual week in war games. Apparently there's a Battleground Games and Hobbies annual 40K Mega Battle, and I've heard about this previously, but I'm looking forward to hearing it again. There's a Hazard contest update or a convention update?
Convention.
And on my end, I just recently received the Force on Force rules, recently being literally this evening. I've had a chance to flick through it and sniff it alone. And yeah, just various bits and pieces of me. But I wanted to start, Jonathan, I have a bone to pick with you.
Sure thing.
And it's the kind of thing that, I don't know, just kind of irritates me slightly. About a year and a half ago, there was a video podcast called Incoming. Made by a fellow called Neil Shook. And Neil is a longtime friend of the podcast. He was going to be on this evening. He may be on next show. Obviously, I think by now, Neil and my chat has hit the CWF Gamecast feed. So my hope is that fans will know Neil by now. There was a video podcast called Incoming about a year and a half ago, run by Neil Shook. And recently, and I should explain my relationship with Incoming. Because as I hold a copy of Force on Force in my hands, Neil Shook could tell me to go and buy the Golden Gate Bridge and I would go out and buy it. And he used to have this video podcast, which was really good. Did you ever see any of the early episodes of Incoming on YouTube?
I gotta say, I'm a latecomer to Neil Shook's endeavors. So I sadly missed out on that. But I did give them a look more recently.
Of course.
Which is where I know you're going.
So this is like miniature porn. I mean, I'm not sure if we can even use that term because it has been censored previously, but literally this is just, it has no intellectual merit. It is purely putting disgustingly beautiful figures in front in order for people to kind of ogle and then go and purchase. So when I heard this week that Neil was resuming Incoming, but in audio podcast form, I thought, well, at least I won't have to look at these miniatures. Boy, was I wrong. And we have one person to blame here, and Neil actually blames this person at the start of the podcast.
He does.
But I just want to say, Jonathan, I have emailed myself like half a dozen links from his first episode to. So he's basically postponing the element by doing it as an audio podcast while I'm at work. I have to jot down notes of the miniature pages that I need to look up. And anyway, hats off to you, hats off to Neil. I think this new version of Incoming is a great endeavor, and apparently you're responsible.
Well, I gave it a listen yesterday because you had told me that I should listen to his latest release. And I was like, oh, there's a new Meeples and Miniatures. I thought maybe, you know, he got it out like extra early or something. And so I look at my feed on iTunes and I see, okay, it has a different title. It's called Incoming 2.0. Maybe he's just, you know, being a little quirky or something. So my wife and I were sitting down and we're listening to it. And then out of nowhere I hear, and I blame Jonathan Reiner. I was like, whoa, what? Apparently he seems to like what we're doing. But I gotta say, I was, Neil, I know you listened, but I was a huge fan of your first episode of that. I thought it was perfect. I thought the length was good. I love the content. And like you, Tom, I was actually, I was at a computer at the time, so I was going online and looking up places and, oh, what place is he talking about now? And, oh, that fig, and let me see. And so I think it's going to be a big success.
I just need to, as I did previously with the video podcast, I would always do it at home, the comfort of my own house, where I had an internet connection. But I thought, stupidly, I could listen to this at work, no more. No more listening to Incoming at work. I'm just going to have to be in front of a computer listening to it. I used to listen to it on a Sunday evening, actually, and I think the translation to audio is probably a good one for Neil, just in terms of the frequency and the editing. But when it was in video as well, it was just because then basically you could see the figures as you could hear him talk about it. Well, but yeah, I think phenomenally good format, Neil. Big thumbs up from me. Thumbs up from Jonathan.
There is one way, Neil, that you could keep it as an audio format, but insert some pictures. You could do it in enhanced podcasts, which is something that I used to do, not very often, mind you, but way back in the day.
I think that might add to the time frame, though. Neil wants to get it out quickly, and I do understand – his need to get it out quickly. So clearly we are capable. We, the zombified listeners, are capable of actually finding the links independently. And Neil, you don't need to do a video podcast with regards to this one, mate. You've just done it perfectly.
It's very good.
Hats off to you. So shout out to Neil Shook and Jonathan, you're the
blame.
So anyway, this is a funny topic because I didn't see any of the podcast problems that you're describing. In fact, I think it's funny because I download the podcast just fine, irrespective of the bad feed or not. And my suspicion is that maybe with newer versions of iTunes or something, when podcast feeds have problems, they'll still go to the files and try to pull them down. And the problem that Jonathan saw in particular was that some of the files were like one byte or something instead of the proper length. Which, did you actually have problems on iTunes with it, or was it just that you noticed the feed was wrong?
Well, I gotta say, for someone who podcasts, I know next to nothing about feeds and RSS and aggregators and any of that. Do you know what? I need to learn about it. It's not something I'm good with. I'm here
but
for the
content. I guess my question to you is, was it a real problem that you encountered with iTunes, or was it just you browsing through the feed saying, why is this one byte long?
I happened to be in iTunes and I was going through my podcasts and I noticed that two of our episodes only had 1 second of audio and I thought, well, that can't be right. And I checked in. I have our shows like two or three times in iTunes because I have different versions of them, the local version plus the version that goes out on the feed. So I compared to what else I had and I saw, okay, well, no, clearly, you know, I do have a correct file size, but it's not what got onto iTunes. So I played the 1 second audio to see what was going on. In case maybe, you know, it really was the full show, but iTunes was just being stupid.
Yeah, that's funny because I think the download part versus the play online is different. And I've had complaints with regards to, well, play online just takes longer to update too. They're different technologies. The thing that actually pulls it down is obviously like a direct contact with the RSS feed, whereas the play through the iTunes website is something different. But in short, I didn't see any of these problems as a download, whatever, subscriber via iTunes. Except I got the opportunity to listen to the show 51 twice, which, you know, I don't know. One out of two of the hosts is reasonable to listen to, and the other guy just sounds familiar to me. But aside from that, that was reasonable listening. So I understand that you've also received some mail recently.
Yeah, actually. We've gotten some feedback, whether it's via instant messaging or I get stuff via text message and mail.
Or it's listening to other podcasts that talk about deceased estates.
Well, exactly. Do you know what? I think I just came up with a new contest, which is going to appear sometime down the road. But for now, I have to keep it to myself. Anyway, the mail, so like you said, from other podcasts, or also get things as comments on our blog. So I actually got tons of comments about all sorts of stuff, but most of them deal with black powder. And the first one actually that deals with black powder is the fact that, Tom, when you and I talk about black powder, we are talking about the Warlord Games black powder rule set. I think that we may not always make that clear. It can be a little confusing, whereas it's a rule set, but it's also a gaming period. So some of the listeners might have a little confusion. I know one person in particular had mentioned that they weren't sure if we were talking about just a time period or a particular rule set. I informed them that, you know, it was the Rick Priestley and Jervis Johnson rule set for Warlord Games that we were talking about. So by and large, whenever we're going to be talking about Black Powder, at least in the foreseeable future, we're probably going to be talking about the Warlord Games rule set. And if we're talking about something else, we'll try to mention it. Sadly, we both, this is what we're talking about, we just kind of, I guess, got uncomfortable with black powder for us being the World of Games rule set, as opposed to that vast span of history.
Yeah, certainly. Just mentioning a kind of follow-on to that, Neil mentioned in his recent episode of Incoming that Warhammer Historicals was releasing a World War II rule set.
I heard that.
And I think he described that some schmucks would buy it no matter what. Well, I'm probably going to be one of those schmucks. So prepare yourself for a rules review in the near future. Okay, now really to the last rules review. In fact, last week I got off the podcast, and who knows when the podcast will actually be coming out. And I looked through the book that I reviewed at the time, which I still have in front of me, actually. This is the benefit of podcasting in the same place, The Brushfire Rules. I was pretty critical, and I felt kind of bad about it afterwards, because I thought, realistically, this is something that could be reformatted and redone only very slightly to be a really good rule set. And then I realized also that I'd... and I don't even know... my whole notion of time and my perception now associated with this podcast, I've got the same kind of disease that you have associated with this, Jonathan. Because I don't... Did I mention in episode 51 of the War of Pandu podcast I'd paid out, like, Stephen with regards to not mentioning that he'd been on this podcast?
And actually, I have a bone to pick with you, because in their latest episode... And actually, it's more a bone to pick with Steven, I guess. He lumps you and I together, saying that both of us said that he didn't give... any sort of mention or whatever about being on our show after the fact, when, in all honesty, you were calling him out on it, Tom, but that was just because you hadn't heard episode.
The deceased states section of this podcast, which there is, seriously, I'm really going to do a section of this podcast on deceased states, and really, there's a lot of good and interesting information in there, so stay tuned, or we'll be forgiven. So anyway, you received other mail other than just Black Powder-related stuff.
Yeah, actually, quite a bit of it came as a result of comments on our blog on the show notes for episode 51. Well, the mixed version of episode 51. Okay. For those of you who may not know, we did have some problems with the podcast, which we were talking about before. But basically, it's been fixed, and I got some support from the people over at WordPress on their fan and user-run forums. But anyway, got some comments from... nice gentleman, his name is Paul. He has his own gaming blog over at wargamerblue.blogspot.com, and he paints up figures and he talks about different rule sets and stuff. But he actually gave some comments in relation to, Tom, you and I talking about the size of armies, the size of tables, and that sort of stuff for Black Powder. And he basically said that, he thinks you're wrong, Tom, for the size of the army that's needed, and that a lot of people, and by a lot of people, I assume he means a lot of people he games with, use armies the same kind of size that I'm hoping to go for, and he said that they have a lot of fun. So I wrote this lengthy, discourse on, comparing the size of the table and the number of models and stuff, and I referenced the Black Powder rulebook, and, definitions that they use and everything. So it actually kind of, it extrapolated, and then other people got involved. So there was this whole kind of discussion on, what is an ideal table size you need? What's a good army size? And what scales should you use? Because during the discussion, it did come up, like you had mentioned before, that using a smaller scale would allow myself or anyone who's using Black Powder to field a larger force for less money and to represent more of a battle as opposed to a small portion of a battle, which you would have to with 25 or 28 millimeter or larger. I mean, you could go up to 40 millimeter or whatever, that you wouldn't be able to portray as much on the same real estate, because, I mean, otherwise it gets too crowded. So there was a lot of that discussion kind of going on, and I stuck with my guns on the 28 millimeter, partly because I like 15 millimeter, but honestly, I can only handle one 15 millimeter army, and that's Flames of War. So my heart's always kind of 28 millimeter, and I enjoy painting it. But there was a lot
Nothing
of discussion on size.
Any otherwise, Jonathan? I'm not that train has left the station. I'm just counting trousers like the rest of us.
I just thought it was interesting on how there's a rule set like Black Powder or the Hail Caesar one. I think is coming up soon, or will have been. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Neil Shook actually mentioned that he. My hope is that we can get Neil on an upcoming show, and he can give us a little extra on the Hail Caesar rules, because he just received his copy today and he's going to do a joint review. If I go back to the chat log associated with Neil Shook, he's going to do a joint review with Clash of Empires. Oh. So news that, well, by the time this comes out, he's probably already recorded two additional podcasts. But anyway, this was new news when this podcast was recorded. So the general consensus is basically people play Black Powder with a variety of different setups, and I think I have no justification for any of my points in previous podcasts. I just want to apologize at this stage. But the interesting thing through the Black Powder rule set is it doesn't actually identify any points cost in general. So really it would be very interesting to see how small people actually play the battles, whether people have actually played near skirmish games, for example, with the Black Powder rule set. So it just seems to be a... Sorry?
No, I was just saying, I wonder that too, because the end of the book, they kind of, I feel like they threw it together on the point system so you could do a pickup game. But they talk about, you know, how you would alter the distances and, like, how much shooting would change and close combat and all that would change if you went to a larger or smaller scale than 28mm. That the rules are intended for 28, but that you could adapt them to 15, you could adapt them to 10 or 6 or 40, or whatever you wanted to do, whatever you had on hand. So that you would just have to adjust the rules a little bit. And I kind of hesitate to call the Black Powder rulebook rules, because it's more kind of like guidelines, I guess. They're not like, you know, hard and fast. So it's kind of nice that, like, with this, and I'm assuming with Hail Caesar, that it's more open and allows players to use, like, if you have 10mm figures at home or 50mm figs, go ahead and use them. There's no reason that you should have to go out and buy 28mm figs. Or if you prefer 40mm, do 40mm. Again, no reason to do 28 if you don't want to do it, or 25 or whatever. Use it one hand. Or if you found a great army at a deceased estate, and you got it at a good price or whatever, and that's your thing, do that, and whatever the scale is, whatever. I mean, be happy with it. That's, I think that's the point that they try to make throughout the rulebook.
Oh, man. Oh, man. And now we're in a happy place. Let's talk a little bit more about deceased estates. There's one thing about Las Vegas. People come here to retire, and as a necessary consequence of people coming here to retire, also what would commonly be called garage sales in the rest of the U.S., perhaps, maybe Florida, they have deceased estate sales. There are deceased estate sales, and I've got to say, a garage sale is where people leave, like, maybe a quarter of their worst junk out on the curb, and a deceased estate sale is where you walk through someone's house and basically give back to their families. And I feel on a number of levels, and I really, because some of the deceased estate sales I've been to here have just been absolutely phenomenal. We went into one which was a missionary family, and they had a variety of, like, maps. They'd been to Rome in the 1950s and 1960s. There was just some amazing stuff there. I mean, clearly I'm a bibliophile. Clearly I'm, I like old stuff. And as far as I'm concerned, there is nothing neither morbid nor wrong about deceased estates. I think they're in fact. Truth be told, I would like to leave my stuff in that kind of stuff. I mean, if I didn't have people that wanted to pick it up. And the other point that I wanted to make, and this is a very serious topic because it's, aside from this podcast, I also do another podcast called Model Rail Radio. And very similar, and really this is something that goes to Henry Hyde, because this is a discussion that has gone through the Model Rail community very heavily. But actual estate planning for people that collect things, and particularly men that collect things, is actually a very smart thing to do, because typically what happens is that we leave this to our significant others to do after the fact. So while I'm only in my mid-30s, I wouldn't necessarily think this was a problem. I would certainly know that if something were to happen to me, that the stuff that I have, my wife wouldn't know basically whether it had any value, what it was, these kind of things. So there's also a conversation, aside from just the fun I get going through deceased estates in Las Vegas, associated with estate planning, which really people should do at almost any age. But, Jonathan, your parents' house is basically held together by your wargaming kind of collections, isn't it? It provides, like, insulation and stuff like that.
Well, it's amazing what the amount of superglue I have over there can do to you.
Very good. Very good. So the notion is, and it's a horror, I mean, you know, people say it's a horrible thing. Having had multiple funerals and various other things this year, I'm considerably more immune to these kind of things. But my sense is anyway that there's a really strong narrative that's currently going through the Model Rail community associated with estate planning. And I think also, and as Henry Hyde notes frequently in his magazine with eulogies and various other narratives, that basically probably the wargaming community also should start considering just documenting what you have and putting, like, rough estimates of what it's worth and these kind of things, and just leaving this kind of information. I mean, I do that because I'm, like, mildly obsessive. I do that kind of stuff anyway, but I probably don't go to the lengths that are necessary. The main problem in the Model Rail community is that there are unscrupulous people that will come in and basically buy up huge collections of trains for literally not even pennies on the dollar, fractions of pennies on the dollar. And in these circumstances, you are dealing with your loved ones, basically. So my feeling is twofold. Firstly, document everything you have. And secondly, if you are buying from a deceased estate, pay a fair price for it, because basically you're supporting, there's a kind of strange ebb and flow here, but you're really supporting the family of a fellow wargamer or these kind of things at a moment of need. So I don't think the narrative associated with deceased estates or deceased armies or any of these things is really anything to snicker about. I think actually it's quite a serious point that probably needs to be made, that irrespective of how young you are, if you have these large collections, and as Jonathan and I have talked about, we have spouses that have next to no interest in anything we do. Well, maybe that's my narrative versus Jonathan's. But anyway, the nature of these things, they need to be documented. So it does take a lot of time. I mean, even I photographed my miniatures for insurance purposes a year or two ago, and it took probably 6 hours worth of time. And I don't have a huge collection. I'm not like Jonathan. I've only got like a cubic meter's worth of stuff. Maybe a little bit more. Maybe, yeah, well, anyway, something like that. But no, I'm no degenerate like Jonathan. Anyway, so
people are.
So my view is it does take a bit of time, but it's just peace of mind after the fact. And quite frankly, I can't imagine my wife doing anything with my miniature collection. But I know that if she sold it for a fair price, she could, you know, live quite comfortably. So that's really what deceased estates, as far as I'm concerned, with regards to the specific hobby you're about. And I would empower Henry Hyde to look at some of the stuff that's coming out in the model rail community, because clearly he's also identifying a market that seems to be aging and these kind of things. Because I think it's actually something which is very positive and very good, and actually thinking about circumstances which are clearly a little bit morbid, but at least best to give them a positive circumstance. So, yeah, for all of our listeners, that was my little piece on deceased estates, sponsored by the What Would Pat Do podcast. Great group of guys. Luke, I'm hoping that you'll learn not to put your models, your plastic models, your resin models in paint stripper.
Oh, God, that was awful.
I just can't... I don't necessarily want to narrate this, because this will just become a flame war, or even a flames of war flame war. But, yeah, enough said with regards to that. Read the side of the bottle before you put any of your models in it. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how... I used a lot of paint stripper when I was in the UK, but I would never, ever put anything plastic in. I think one time, actually, I thought it was a metal arm, but it was a plastic arm. But, yeah, there, the stuff they used was like, it was like some kind of gel substance, which was really, really noxious. And when you put water on it, it started to bubble. I remember that as well. But anyway, yeah, keep your, keep your resin away from paint stripper. That's Little Factoid, was sponsored by the What Would Pan Do? Use from the Front podcast. Have at it, guys. Have at it.
Tom, I think you made some really good points about deceased estates. And around here, we have, you know, estate sales from time to time. I work in a very wealthy town, so people like to go there for yard sales and garage sales and estate sales and stuff, because, honestly, the people have nice stuff is what it comes down to. And I work with one person whose father passed away 3 years ago. He was a professor at Harvard, you know, very well-traveled, very smart, escaped the Nazis by the skin of his teeth from Greece. But he didn't do any sort of estate planning. He had this gigantic, beautiful house in a very well-to-do town nearby, and a very historic home and stuff, but he didn't do anything. The place was full of all sorts of historical documents and, you know, books. He loved books and magazines and all sorts of amazing, interesting kind of stuff, paraphernalia and artwork and stuff. But since he didn't do any sort of planning at all, it was all left to his kids and my coworker, being the oldest and the one who lives out here, had to deal with it. It took over 2 years of her life to deal with it. They're still not done. They're trying to find a seller for the house who won't tear it down. And she's lost so much money on it, just trying to basically clean up his mess is what it is. And I'm sure at that.
And I think that's the interesting point, that what you're actually doing is translating what will be necessarily a sad time anyway into something which is just going to be considerably more stressful. And I know you're slightly younger than I am, Jonathan, but I think this is something that even people of our age should seriously consider, because if the worst happens, you know, you need to have papers in place, you need to have stuff in place, because basically it just comes down to, you know. And the important thing about the local deceased estate sales, the families have always been through first. It's not like, you know, the stuff that is left over is the stuff, as you describe, people move away, these kind of things, their children don't necessarily want to take the Mustang, 1960s Mustang, or a variety of other things, all the books and these kind of things. So almost all the deceased estate sales that I go to here, clearly the family has been through before, But I think it is something, the whole notion of estate planning and these kind of things is something, particularly because when you have eclectic hobbies, as we do, you immediately assume that these things have implicit value, and to a small group of the population, they do. So if you can get the small group of the population that understands the implicit value to pay the money back, then it's not like a complete loss and recoup. And I think the other thing is associated with, well, just kind of aging element of the hobby, which obviously Henry Hyde has kind of, well, discussed in his magazine through through various epitaphs and other things, is that you need to be very cognizant of just having this discussion. And I think it's important that podcasts have this discussion because ultimately, you know, we're conveying the information to folks who may just look at their collections and think, well, you know, it has value. Well, it has value because you know it has value, but if you don't describe that in any way, shape, or form, others that come to it may not know its value. Anyway.
One, on a related topic, actually, and I can't think of the name of it, but I remember reading about people who play MMOs that, you know, sometimes people play these things of all ages, whether you're, you know, my age or you're older or whatever, that there's some sort of service or group you can belong to so that if you don't log in X number of time, presumably because you're dead or, you know, you're over in Libya and you can't get out or something, that, like, a notice gets sent to all of your in-game friends so they know that, you know, something terrible had happened to you and that you're not going to be coming back, most likely. So in some way, it's kind of like gamers are kind of doing, like, a watered-down version of this kind of estate planning. Like, you know, they realize they're not going to be here forever, that the game might be here longer, but how to let these people know what's going on that they may not actually know in real life. It's just kind of, I find it interesting.
Anyway, we normally start with a week in gaming, but because I had a bone to pick with you, I'm just moving into the week in gaming. Have you never had fish and chips previously?
No, do you know what? I never.
You have never? Because Boston isn't, like, known for its seafood at all, is it?
No, not at all. But since I'm not British, I've never had fish and chips. Never.
I was just absolutely astonished. And I'm sure because we have listeners in the UK. Because you can even order fish and chips here. I mean, it's pretty well omnipresent here in Vegas. I don't know whether it's because there's an expat population. But I was just absolutely astonished. I mean, firstly,
what Tom's talking about is sometime in April, depending on when you are listening to this, my wife and I went away to Rockport, Massachusetts, which is this really old, historic, quaint New England seaside town. It's one of the oldest towns in all of Massachusetts. And we went there to go away for the weekend to celebrate her birthday. And, of course, being on the scene, being in New England, there's tons of seafood, great seafood. Like, if you are in the area and you want some great seafood, you really need to go to Rockport, because you can go there, you can do your shopping, you can... I sound like I'm working for the Rockport Chamber of Commerce. But while there, you know, I was taking pictures and putting them up on Facebook and stuff. And one of the pictures was of a meal I had, which was fried haddock and french fries and, I don't know, other stuff. And my caption on it was, first time having fish and chips ever. And I'm sure that's not really what fish and chips is traditionally for people elsewhere in the world who have it. So for those of you who live elsewhere and who are used to real fish and chips, feel free to send us, you know, information about your favorite fish and chips and, you know, where I should go to get some great fish and chips. But
so here's the interesting point. In Australia, most of Australia, when they serve fish and chips, it's actually shark, not fish, that they serve. They call it flake, but it's basically a gummy shark. So, but most other areas, it's just cod and chips. And there's an interesting story in the UK that I remember hearing about. They were talking about how the First World War munitions workers, basically, their ability to eat fish and chips on a regular basis was why England won the war, the First World War. And it's interesting because I think the fish come from the south and the chips come from the north or something like that. Like, it's a mixture of two cuisines. But, yeah, no, I know our Irish and Scottish listeners are going to respond with great ire here. The UK in general, including Ireland, amazing fish and chips. Tasmania has regionally, I think, some of the best fish and chips. They put butter in the batter somehow in Tasmania. I can't work that out, but just amazing batter. I've sampled fish and chips the world over. I was just absolutely astonished that you had never experienced fish and chips previously.
I'm not a big seafood guy. It's very odd. I'll have, you know, shrimp. I'll have scallops. I've recently got into tilapia, but I'm not really into fish. I'm not really into seafood.
So sushi is completely... You don't eat sushi?
I've had it, and I mean, I like it, but if it's between that and going and getting, like, a salad or something, I'll go grab a salad.
Okay. Hence, you own rabbits and we own cats, I guess.
There is that, too. He takes on the grocery bill when everyone in the house eats the same thing.
I think so. So anyway, sorry, you're weak in wargaming, Jonathan. What have you been up?
Actually, that does tie into my week in wargaming, and I'll start with that. As I said, we were in Rockport, and one of the shops there, and there's lots of shops, if you're into like artwork and all sorts of like interesting kind of things, it's a great place to go. But one of the shops is called the Pewter Store, something like that.
Ooh.
And they make pewter there. A pewter object, spoons, and you name it, they make it, and they make it on site the way they used to make it. And one of their display cases, and I'm kicking myself because I didn't buy them, but they had wonderful painted pewter models of toy soldiers from, I don't know when, but they were fantastic looking. They kind of reminded me of the Spencer Smith toy soldiers that I've seen Henry Hive. Photograph in Battle Games magazine. I don't know if they were Spencer Smith or if they were just something they had made in-house or what it was, but they were fantastic looking, and the place was really crowded, which was unusual because it's off-season. But we went in, and we did like this big, you know, walk around the entire place and through all the different rooms, and then I came back and I looked at them, and then actually my wife left the store thinking I was following her, and meanwhile I doubled back to go look at the models again, and then she had to come back in and be like, oh, where'd you go? But they had fantastic toy soldiers, so I don't know how often they'll keep them in, or if it's, you know, what you see is what you get, but I really should have bought those things. I have no idea.
Have you ever considered pouring your own?
Do you know what? That's an interesting topic. I know someone who does cast some of their own models. I don't really want to get into it because of what they cast, but...
Say no more. Yeah, when I was younger, there was a company called Prince August that still exists. I follow the fellow on Twitter. And they made a series of Pour Your Own. And when I was in the UK, I bought a series of their molds. And then Kirill Kenev, who has come up in a previous podcast, made some beautiful molds for me, which I still have, as well as the Prince August molds, actually. It is really quite fun. You need to do it in an open-air environment. I bought, I think, 5 kilos of lead in the UK, and then smelted it down and wide variety of things. If you spend too much time in the company of lead, you will feel it. It is, it affects you. Probably my bones will be preserved for all eternity from the amount of vaporous lead that I've consumed. But it is really fun, and it is, particularly if you're into Napoleonics and things like that, it is a really easy way to cast up, mysteriously, hundreds and hundreds of... 28 mil figures. This I should have given you this as advice. The pour your own scenario, and particularly also the thing that I got into was then doing conversion. So you pour, like I had a series of orcs, for example. I had various poses with swords and what have you. Once you've poured 15 of these orcs in a row, and you've got, you know, 15 orcs behind, you start breaking off arms, putting them together with green stuff, and you can actually make really quite interesting armies with these kind of posable things. I sawed off a couple of heads, I moved a few things around, I basically changed up various... And it gives you a degree of freedom associated with just the fact that these things are now literally pennies on the dollar of what you would pay normally. Truth be told, and I know that there are people that do various illegal casting, in fact, ironically... I had a long communication with the head of Games Workshop IP around the same time I was communicating with Carol about this lead rot issue. And a lot of older figure collectors have noticed in their collections that the lead actually, like, rots. And what it is it's an oxidization process that gets between the folds of the metal and basically the figures disintegrate. Now, if you buy cheap reproductions, they're far more likely to have the lead rot because they're not uniformly cast. And if you drop cast yourself, you can have problems with that too. Increasingly, the metals that you get, your metals you purchase, you get more and more pewter now. In fact, the lead that I purchased was a substantial portion pewter and melted at high temperature. It holds a better fidelity too. But I would thoroughly recommend for folks who can get in relatively open-air environments that are really careful. There's actually a train show happening a bit south of you where they're doing live lead pours, and the people I've spoken to, I've said, you really don't want to be close to people that are pouring lead. It's just not... It's something that's very focused. You want to basically probably do it alone and have your wits about you and be, you know, in an open-air environment to do it, because it is quite dangerous. I would wear very thick gloves, face gear, a wide variety of other things when I poured lead. It's not the kind of thing, although Prince August did sell to children originally, it is the kind of thing where I think maybe a 12 or 13-year-old with a father or a parent present probably could do it. But I had a great degree of fun doing it, and I would thoroughly recommend to people, particularly those that are considering larger armies, like Napoleonics and what have you, where you want to just get the figures out, start experimenting, start throwing stuff around. It is still quite a fun hobby, and you can get access. In the UK, it was a lot easier to get access to the metal. But sorry, with regards to your discussion associated with Rockport, seeing those figures, they are the easiest, really, to cast. And like I say, Prince August, which is an Irish company, makes a variety of rubber molds for casting that kind of stuff. Anyway, sorry. Continuing on with your week in Morgan.
Yeah, so they had the toy soldiers, and I mean, the toy soldiers look good. Nowhere near as detailed as, you know, some Perry models or anything. But honestly, I haven't really come across a whole lot of models which are as detailed as the Perrys, or as interesting for me as the Perrys. I'm sure they don't tickle everyone's fancy, but for me, they're what I like. But anyway, the biggest news, I guess, in my week in wargaming is that I have finally finished my first six Black Powder models. Why, thank you, thank you. So that's all done. They're, you know, varnished and coated and sealed and et cetera, et cetera. They are not based, though, because I realized very quickly that if I want this project to take, you know, an eternity, I will base everything separately. So I'm going to avoid that and either base, like, a regiment at a time or base the entire army at once. Plus, that'll give a uniform cohesion to the basing, and that way I don't have to worry about, did I use, like, four parts of this and one part of that, and etc. So they're done. There's actually pictures up on the blog about them, and I describe the process that I use or whatever. So if you are interested in how I have painted my guys, you will be able to see that online. Speaking on the blog, I did lots of blogging, actually, about all sorts of different stuff, and spent actually quite a bit more time listening to the one of them anyway, CDs Stratos sent, the Autumnal Slumber. I've been listening to that every single day to and from work now, and I could definitely hear some of the issues you were having, mainly with the drum. But one thing about me, I can tune out just about anything. I'll be at work, and
well, podcast with me. I mean, that goes without saying, doesn't it?
At work, I can just get so focused that, like, there have been times things have gone off and, like, sounds have done, and I haven't had any idea. I mean, once when I was younger, I slept through part of fire. So
I've slept through a fire as well. I have a question for you. Did you forward, I can't remember whether it was you or Henry Hyde, I think it was probably you, who forwarded me some photographs from Henry Hyde playtesting a game. Was that you or was that Henry directly?
I wish I could say that was me, but I bet you it was Henry.
Yeah, I received these photos this morning, and I was looking at this game board. He has sheep on round bases. In, like, individual sheep that participate in his war game.
Is this for his... Oh, do you know what? He's working on that mini rule set that's going to be included in his book, which, according to Amazon, you can buy in, like, 3 months, although that's, you know, not true. So if you're looking on Amazon and you see Henry Hyde's book, you really can't buy it in, like, 2 months.
I couldn't find it, actually. I couldn't find it. He mentioned it, and I immediately searched for it so I could buy it now at whatever price they were charging at the time.
Maybe it got taken down.
Yeah, maybe it got taken down. It can happen. But the thing that struck me was he had individual sheep and a sheep herder, a shepherd, on separate round bases that were, like, off the side. I mean, originally they were, like, literally in the center of the battle, and then progressively they moved to one side as, I guess, the soldiers were marching in. I don't know. I don't know how much experience Henry has had with sheep, but if they are getting their own rule set in this game, they do pretty well run from anything that sounds loud. So I was kind of a bit puzzled by the fact that the sheep were almost like a skirmish unit moving between the two armies at various points. But, Henry, please do include sheep rules, and please do credit them to your friend from the Southern Hemisphere, and we'll take it as that, because I think sheep are what is missing from modern wargaming.
I think you might be right, although I'm sure they would have a poor leadership score.
Well, they did have a shepherd. You know, well, the shepherd has higher leadership.
Leadership 9, maybe?
Yeah, I'm thinking leadership 7. But anyway, if he has a dog, maybe leadership 9.
That's true, plus 1.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. 2 dogs, 9. Easy. Anyway, so
you don't want to get crazy with the dogs. So those canines, you got to feed and house them and train them, and I don't know.
Exactly. And then they start leading the army. Anyway, continue.
They do. So one of the blogging things I actually had done is something that I did for Mike Hawk at Battlefront Miniatures. He asked me to, you know, if I could get him the old podcast from before you had resurrected things and rebooted the franchise, so to speak. So I actually condensed... Well, no, that's not the right word. I compiled all of the episodes of the show up to and including episode 51, and I zipped it into a single file, and then I made it available on the blog. Before people jump up and down, please keep in mind, first of all, that in my opinion, all the shows before Tom are awful. That the content might be good, but the shows themselves aren't so great. My performance was dreadful, and... this is probably odd to say, but I really can't recommend listening to them other than, you know, if you just want to listen and get a laugh. But if you are interested...
No, look, Jonathan, no, honestly, I'm a long-term fan of this podcast, even prior to, obviously, my splendid introduction. And I have to say, within the surreal elements, there are glimmering hopes throughout the CWF Gamecast, and I would thoroughly recommend folks listening in. Things like Music to Game By... a long discussion associated with your addiction to pre-painted minis, various lamentings about Games Workshop. I mean, imagine the Games Workshop discussions that Jonathan and I have had, but just without my part, and then you basically got the previous history. A wide variety of things, which I think actually... I mean, I recall when I first started listening to your show, and in particular I went on iTunes and found a series of quite marginal reviews and then posted a really positive review... because I think you represented very much the kind of quintessential, I don't know, early 20s gamer, kind of working out basically where your dollars were going to go and admitting when you had a problem associated with buying too much and these kind of things. I think you're selling yourself short, Jonathan. I think the what we'll call the CWF Gamecast classics are well worth listening to. And I think really... when when Meeples and Miniatures started to dip, when Henry and Neil stopped recording for 6 or 7 months, you know, there was a reason that I contacted Jonathan, because I thought if any of the previous Wargaming podcasts were going to be resurrected, it was going to be Jonathan J. Reinhardt. So I connected the electrodes, the lightning came down, and CWF Gamecast was resurrected.
Well, it's very kind of you to say, Tom. But... I can't listen to them, but I'm glad people like them. So if you do download the zip file, be warned. The zip file itself is over 2 gigs. All told, it's about 30 to 35 gigs of audio. There's, you know, 51 episodes, I guess, show, plus 3 of the enhanced episodes, which I kind of mentioned earlier, some of the mini episodes, and then just some little things here and there. But there's actually one episode I'm kind of proud of. But for a weird reason, it's one of the earlier ones, and at that time, I was trying to get a co-host, which was very elusive. So it was the first time my then co-host actually was on the show, and to kind of commemorate it, he was friendly at the time with Andy Chambers, so we had this kind of roundabout interview where he and I would talk about stuff, and then he was actually live chatting with Andy Chambers and would convey the questions and stuff and kind of facilitate things back and forth. So there's no actual audio of Andy on the show for that episode, which is something what I really had wanted. Yes. But there's a little bit of that going back. So you can kind of see, because that's at the time shortly after Andy had left Games Workshop and set it up his own consultant business. And after he had done a lot of stuff with Mongoose Publishing for Starship Troopers, which I talked about Mongoose a lot back in the day, but the show goes back to 2006. So there's, you know, many years worth of audio to listen to. But it's all in a compiled archive, so to speak, and you can download that from our blog. Yeah.
I don't think I actually remember that Andy Chambers in the background episode.
Yeah, September 3rd, 2006.
Wow. I thought I was your biggest fan, but you have proven me wrong, Jonathan. Well,
to quote, I want to quote Stephen McLaughlin, and I can't even find... He said something really funny in the previous episode of the WWPD, I think he said something like, oh, I guess you're not really that big of a fan of theirs after all, which I'm going to actually, I'm going to be using that as a tagline in some audio I'm putting together for our show to try to get people to subscribe. So anyway, that's basically my week in gaming. I mean, I played some games of Pandemic, continuing the winning streak.
Very good.
Did some planning for Huzzah, which I actually want to talk about when we talk about HuzzahCon. With that, so my week was relatively boring, other than, you know, painting and taking a trip and that kind of stuff. How about you?
Well, I received some interesting feedback on Field of Chaos earlier. I had it with a fellow with the New York Times, which is just like maximum stress for author, you know, for that period. And in that period, I got an email from a reader saying that he had found 13 typos, which I then promptly corrected and put out a second edition. So I got out a second edition of Field of Chaos last week relatively promptly, and now I have all these first edition copies, which no doubt are going to be worth a small fortune, which will be going to prize support in future future CWF Monty and the Fox podcasts. From that also, I've been looking at the rule set that I've been working on, but also going back to kind of Noble 8, Noble Warfare-related development with the view that some of the source code will also be put in the book. So in terms of actual miniature gaming, not a lot this week. In terms of writing and putting rules together and source code writing, quite a bit. I'm trying to think of anything else. I have the Force of Force rules in front of me, like I said. I really have only literally had 10 minutes to look at them. So I don't want to talk too much about it. My plan is probably to get the Afghan and Vietnam rules. I'm not particularly interested in Iraq, although I have some insurgents. I did hear on the Jonathan J. Reinhardt-sponsored incoming version 2.0 that there is now Emperor's miniatures, although I've always liked Emperor's casts, now have a good variety of modern that I haven't had a chance to look at online. But my suspicion is I'll probably quell some addiction associated with that particular interest group. But no, I'm interested in getting into Force on Force, if nothing more than to provide a review to our listeners. I'm probably going to be slightly more critical than Neil was, mainly because I paid my own money for it. But I think the...
That'll do it.
I think the general rules are, from my initial precursory read, are, as you say, with regards to Black Powder, probably considerably more sketch than rules. And also, I was a little bit suspicious of the broad period. And this is the thing that interests me about, well, also the potential Warhammer historical rule, Second World War rules, that they focused down very heavily on a relatively tight period. Force on Force still, I mean, Force on Force used to cover Second World War through to present day. And my suspicion is, well, I'm interested in reading their insurgent rules. I haven't gotten into that yet, but my main play interest is really the irregular forces element and how they actually cover irregular forces. In contrast, I see a lot of pictures and a lot of descriptive rules associated with regular forces. And quite frankly, this is what I'm also looking for with War Games Illustrated issue 282. Is it 282? 282 is the Vietnam rules. Because I think the irregular forces are never given a fair cop in these rule sets. And quite honestly, if the irregular forces were as poor as some of these rules portray them, we wouldn't still be in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the nature of these kind of forces is probably misunderstood. I am reading in parallel the Taliban. Where's the other book that I'm reading? I'm sorry, Jonathan. I have this other book ready, but unfortunately I'm picking up the... No. I have another book associated with insurgent warfare that I found absolutely fascinating, which mysteriously... Here we are. Military Tricks, Battlefield Rules of the Islamic Insurgents. I have a series of these books by H. John Poole. I have given them a relatively critical review on the Stone 8 podcast, but the more I read them, the more they accurately seem to describe a wide variety of insurgent tactics. And I guess if you read specifically into insurgent and irregular tactics, and then you look at a rule set which is considerably more regular-centric, you may not be able to get the same kind of criticism. So I think the review that I will give on Force on Force is from the irregular-slash-insurgent-slash-Viet-Cong perspective, because I think those tactics have really poorly been represented in rule sets previously. So that is a little what to expect potentially next episode. In fact, it would be really cool if we could get Neil Shook on the next episode where I give this review.
That would be pretty because good.
Because I think you need, that would really give the full full spectrum contrast, so to speak. Yeah, so let's hope we could arrange that. Or alternatively, Neil and I could record something separately that could either be put in the show or put as a separate podcast, because obviously when Neil and I get together, we just like to talk anyway. So that is coming up. Aside from that, I think that's pretty well my week in wargaming. So, Battleground Games and Hobbies. When am I going to have the chance to actually interview the owner and what's the fellow's name?
Derek?
What's the other fellow's name? No, Chase. Chase. My man Chase. Because these are two people I'd really like to interview.
I'm told soon. I think...
They've never heard this show previously. They don't know what they're in for, do they?
I gotta say that right now they are focused on the next appearance of the 40K Mega Battle. It's a lot of work. They've been actually doing this for, well, this will be the fourth year. Every year they do it, every year it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Every year, am I right in recalling that they actually either like completely redo or just like do new scenery every year?
Yeah, they do new tables every single year for it.
Yeah.
People create new armies every year for it. A friend of mine, his name is Cookie, he's working on using the new, I guess, a Chaos Dreadnought kind of Titan models that are out there, like mini Titans. There's some sort of Knight Titan thing you can use. I think it's for Chaos. And he's intending to have an entire army of them for the event this year. But every year people, they started off small with the bare minimum for the Apocalypse Mega Battles, as, you know, shown in, I guess it was White Dwarf. It must have been on the GW website back in, let's see, this is their fourth year, so 2006, is that right? My math's probably off. But when they started, so it was the bare minimum then, and then it's grown. This year, they're looking, I think most people are going to have 4,000 points minimum to get into it.
So basically, every year, people have been growing their armies, but there are also people that are doing different armies every year?
Yep, there's one guy I know, he has, he has at least 12 to 13 40K armies, each one's between 3,000 and 4,000 points.
Oh my goodness. This is not a married man.
No, he's in college now, actually. An equal number, if not greater, of fantasy. All his stuff is painted incredibly well. He came in third place for painting at the one and only grand tournament that GW here had in Boston many moons ago. He's a fantastic painter. He assembles very quickly. Everything looks really good. It comes easily to him. He knows how to play this stuff, but through and through, he's a space orc kind of guy.
So very good.
You would like him very much.
Very good.
But all of the people have tons and tons of stuff. This year, they're doing it at the same venue as last year. It got to be so big, they had to move it out of the store. So last year, they booked one of the ballrooms at a nearby hotel.
Gosh.
And this year, they booked the grand ballroom, and they're going to be having... it's huge space.
What are the dates for this?
Yeah, actually, I have a whole thing, and I don't want to read the entire thing because it's incredibly long. But
is it May or when is it?
They have this whole like release on Facebook / on the their message board. But they're running the fourth annual 40K Apocalypse Mega Battle on Saturday, June 4th.
Wow.
They're asking that each person have 4,000 points. The kicker is all your models have to be completely painted. We're talking at least three colors per figure. To get in, it's $50 per person. That covers registration, that covers lunch, it covers all the coffee you can drink, and it covers a t-shirt commemorating the fourth annual Mega Battle. It starts at 9 in the morning, setup's at 10, game should end by 10 at night, if not later, so it's a long day. It's going to be held at the Holiday Inn in Rockland, and they actually got... It's such a big thing, and such a big thing for the hotel, that they negotiated a block of rooms at a special room rate, like you would at a convention. So they got the rooms down to 119 a night. They're looking for 60 people, 30 per side. So they split it up between, you know, order like the... Basically the Forces of the Imperium, along with the Tau, for some reason. And Disorder, which would be, you know, everyone from Chaos down to Necrons and Space...
Yeah, no, I think the Tau and the Necrons, that's the general breakdown, that basically, like, Tau and Necrons on one side, the other side, basically. I think it is GW standard, actually, to break them down that way, and you're right, Tau and Necrons are both kind of question marks, but anyway.
Seems a little odd to me. But
yeah.
So they had 40 people last time. They're looking for 60 people this time. Unfortunately, the numbers are down for registration because a lot of people who played before can't play now. Some people are going to be out of the country. Some people are going to be out of the state. So they've actually lowered the points, required points for people. If you have less than 4,000 points and you want to get in, you should still register. You should still talk to Chase Laquadara, chaselaq@gmail.com. And whatever, if you have 2,000 points, for example, they're going to take the other 2,000 points and they'll divide it up amongst people on your team. So
Very cool. No
side's going to have fewer points. It's still going to be whatever it is. And Tom, you're the math guy, so you can probably figure out what 4,000 points at 60 people is. But
two, 240,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're looking for people. You register, like I said, they need you to prepay, unfortunately, because, I mean, it's expensive to book the room. It's expensive for
all
of
them. So if people just want to observe this thing going on, is there an observer rate?
You get in for free. If you're not a player, you come in.
Oh, man.
I've gone every year they've had it, and the last 2 years, I've taken pictures. Last year, I live blogged it, and I actually have a video from the second year that Derek is a big movie buff. He loves to take video. He has he said he has 6 external hard drives, each one between 2 and 4 terabytes full of video that he's like movies he's actually taken, edited, added music to, and stuff. Mm. He's really into it. So he did a video. He does video every year, but he's only released a video from the second year because by the time he gets to the other video, he's on to something else. So No other video ever gets released. It's kind of a joke at Battleground that, oh, when's a video going to be done, Derek? And, you know, he has his son is 2, I think, now. His son will be graduated from college by the time the video comes out, is my opinion.
Maybe his son can release the video. Maybe he needs to get his son editing, and that would actually get the videos out faster.
That could do it. So if you register, you just need, like I said, you email Chase, chaselaq@gmail.com. You got to tell them what size T-shirt you are. You need to give an email address. And then you also, of course, have to say what side you're going to play, how many points you have. And then you need to create an account on their message boards. It's an internet message board. It's free. If you don't already have one, and most people who go to Battleground do, you need to create one because they set up special child boards, for those of you who know internet message board kind of stuff. They create like a subboard, one for disorder and one for order, and only the people on your team get that, so you can kind of plan what you're going to do.
Strategize them as well. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, very good.
So this is their big year of doing it. It's the fourth year. And you are restricted on what codices you can actually use. So if you do an order, you can do Black Templars, Blood Angels, Grey Knights, Dark Eldar, Eldar or Dark Angels, Imperial Guards, generic Space Marines, Space Wolves, Tau, Codex Witch Hunters, although I thought they just came out with the new one anyway, or Crute Mercenaries. And then if you're doing Disorder, you can do Chaos.
Did you mention Imperial Guard?
Yep.
Okay.
So Disorder, you can also have Chaos Demons, Chaos Marines, Dark Eldar, you can do Imperial Guard, which would be a traitor or a renegade themed. It has to be modeled that way, too.
People
might be like, these are actually traitor guard. Well, you didn't model them that way, so it's not WYSIWYG. Necrons, Space Orcs, although they call them Orcs, but they're Space Orcs, and Tyranids. And they do say that you can use any of the Imperial Armor lists by Forge World.
Ooh.
There are always super heavies in this. There have been Thunderhawks, there have been homemade Titans, there have been purchased Titans. If you go on our blog, and actually in the show notes to this episode, I'll link to the previous postings I've done. But in the last year's one, two people actually had made gigantic Titans. They just kind of made them themselves. And I got to tell you, they're half as big as I am. And I'm 6 feet, over 200 pounds, half as big as I am. And they're fantastic. They put them up on the tables, and it's amazing to see what people do with this kind of stuff. They get really into it. It is the biggest 40K gaming event in Southeast Massachusetts, if not all of Massachusetts. People come from all around to watch, to play in it. People talk about it for years. It's fantastic. So there's a whole lot of stuff in it, and like I said, we'll have links to this in the show notes and, you know, blurb and stuff about it. But it's a huge event. If you're interested in playing, please do. I know 50 seems like it's kind of steep, but you get lunch, you get a t-shirt, you get all the coffee you want, plus it covers your registration for the event. So I think that's not a bad deal.
That sounds absolutely wonderful, Jonathan. It sounds like a phenomenal event. And the sixth year, you're saying?
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. This is going to, this time they're doing it, will be the first time they're making custom press passes.
Wow.
So I will be getting a press pass, and then my friend Drew over at thegatestormers.com is going to be getting one. I don't know if anyone else is, but as far as I know, we're the only two so-called press who
will
be there.
Very good.
But there'll be video, and, you know, I'll be taking pictures.
So are you actually going to be taking video this time that may actually be released versus the official video?
Yeah, do you know what? I will, actually, because I have an iPhone now, so...
You can do like, YouTube Direct, like, continuous stream upload stuff and a wide variety of things.
That's something I'm not familiar with, but I think I'm going to have to learn about it, because that...
The YouTube app will enable you to basically... I think, actually, it's just the regular camera app. I'm not sure, you're with Verizon, right? But I'm not sure, but I mean, with AT&T, we can just upload video.
Yeah, do you know what? I think I can, too. One thing I do know, they are going to do an official stop motion video. Time lapse.
Okay. Yes, yeah.
So there's going to be multiple cameras, video cameras set up, and they're going to have those, plus they're going to have cameras set up throughout the place to just, like, every, I don't know, 3 seconds or 5 seconds or whatever, a picture's going to get taken. And if I can get my hands on those, I will do some sort of photo stream YouTube thing with, I don't know, some sort of music or something. But it's going to be fantastic. I hope they get all 60 people. I hope they max out. And usually, like last year, 40 people played, and there were at least 100 to 150 people who came and participated.
I can imagine.
Watched.
Yeah.
it's amazing. So it's going to be a great event. I'm not going to be there at 9 in the morning because I'm not a morning person, but I'll be there in the afternoon, and I tell my wife, my now wife, that every year it happens, I'm like, you know what, you're not going to see me at all this entire day. I'm just gone because it's an entire day kind of thing. It's fantastic.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the direct coverage. It sounds absolutely phenomenal, Jonathan. And you also had a HazardCon update.
Yeah, actually, last time that we had recorded, I talked about, Hazard, it's this historical gaming convention up in Maine, Portland, Maine. This is the second year they're running it. It's put on by the Maine historical gaming people. And sadly, I don't know their official name. I will have that in the show notes. So anyway, they're doing it. It's going to be May 13th, 14th, and 15th. My wife and I are going to be going up because Portland has all sorts of cool stuff, so she can go do cool stuff. She's not really interested in the convention, but she's going to pop in, I think, at some point to kind of walk
up. Pick up a dragon. At least buy a dragon.
Well, do you know what? Sunday, they have a bring and buy. They call it a flea market, but Sunday, it's the last day of the convention. Today, we're going to be leaving. But they have a bring and buy, so we could very well find some nice dragons at some good prices for her. But I had gone ahead and, booked the hotel. It's the same place before the Fireside Inn, I think it's called. The pictures look fantastic. So we booked it and they negotiated room rates and stuff. It's like $69 for, to sleep for two beds in a room.
Yeah, that's pretty cheap.
I don't think that's bad at all. I think it's like $30 maybe to register for the event. And unlike TotalCon, and this is the one complaint I have about TotalCon, you register for the event and it costs X amount of dollars. But then if you want to play in games or go to events, it costs extra to do those. So if an event's like $3, it's like $1.50 per hour or hour and a half at TotalCon. Whereas here at Huzzah, you just say, oh, do you know what? There's this time slot, and I want to do an event. And at this time slot, I want to do that event. It doesn't cost you any extra, and maybe down the road it will. I don't know. So when I registered, I was trying to figure out what events I wanted to do, and I actually waited to register until I talked with one of my gaming friends, Adrian. He has this blog, actually, through WordPress.com. It's called New England Grognard, negrognard.wordpress.com. And he's one of the guys who's going to be doing Black Powder with me. So we're kind of getting into Black Powder. together, and he's been talking about me and talking about Black Powder on his blog, but we were trying to figure out what events to do, because he went before last year, and I've never been. This is, you know, my first larger gaming con, and I was like, I don't really know what I want to go do, because their event list is huge. Just tons and tons of stuff. So we kind of sat down and figured out what to do, and he ended up finding a Black Powder event for one of the days. So he said he was going to sign up for it, and I said I would sign up for it too. And we coordinated, and turns out I think that's the only event we're going to be playing in. But the events I'm intended to play in, oh, actually, I should back up. My wife and I are going to be getting there Thursday. At least that's the plan for now. And events start Friday night at 7. So for Friday night, I'm going to be playing in, it's a naval game, and it's called Raiders of the Sulu Sea, and I'm really into naval kind of stuff. I blame that on my father, who, at least 24 years retired, U.S. Navy as a chief. But this is a homecrafted 28mm naval game in 18th century Philippines. Mike Payne is running it, and his description says, it's 1775, and the Sultan, whose name I can't pronounce, so I'm going to skip over that, unlike WWPD, who bravely give it a try, ordered his Moro pirates on a slaving raid as retaliation against the Spanish colonizers at Fort Pilar Zamboanga, located on the peninsula in the southern Philippines. This is a lighthearted pirate raid. Kids and adults are welcome. Beginners strongly encouraged. Anything that says beginners, naval, or, you know, you don't need to know a whole lot is something I'm willing to give a try, because I just don't retain a whole lot of stuff. But that looked really interesting, so I'm doing that, and then I wanted to put in for the Black Powder event, which is Battle of OSD, which is for the American Civil War. That's on Saturday afternoon. They actually put allowing 8 people to play in this. It's 28mm. And the guy running it, his name is Chris Bergonzi, and they do a whole description on the battle, which you could actually read about it in Wikipedia and elsewhere. It was one of the largest battles in the South during the American Civil War. And when I say South, I mean like deep South, because this was in Florida. So it should be pretty fantastic to go and play in. It'll be nice to get an actual game of Black Powder in. And then on my last event that I'm doing is Saturday evening. You'll notice I skipped Saturday morning because I'm not a morning person.
Morning person, yes.
And then Sunday you can do events, but I want to make sure I get time to go to the Bring It By and to look around. Plus, I mean, it's like 3 hours, or at least 3 hours up to Maine.
Yeah.
And going to need time to get back because I'm intended to be at work on Monday morning at 9. It's tough working for the state. But anyway... remember the Alamo is the other event I'm going to do. It's 8 players, and it's Legends of the Old West Alamo, 25mm, 1830s Texas, run by a guy named Billy. And, I mean, what's not to love about playing in the Alamo? It's according to the description, it's going to have hundreds of 25mm figures and a 5x4 scale Alamo, 5 foot rather by 4 foot scale.
Oh, okay.
So,
that's a big Alamo. Anyway, continue.
I think it's going to be pretty fantastic. But when I actually went to register, for some reason, I accidentally got registered for 2 events on the same time block. And I was like, oh, well, this isn't right. And I tried to undo it, but I had a little bit of difficulty. So I ended up emailing the people running the con, and they were really nice. You forwarded me to, you know, one of the programmers who went ahead and they made all the changes and stuff, and then they verified what I wanted, and then they told me that I'm all set, I'm in for all the games that I want. So I know that I'm not gonna, like, you register for these things, but they give preference to people who pre-registered first, so if you're not, like, the very first person who wanted it, you might not get it. I'm told last year, since it was the first year, there was a lot of openings that you could go in person to register for the con, and then say, oh, you know, I want to go in this game, I want to go in that one, I want to go in that one, and there was plenty of room. But I was told it was very popular, so I'm assuming this year more people will go, and that perhaps, you know, you might not be able to get into the stuff you want unless you pre-register and get in early. So I don't know if I was just early or if they were being extra nice or what, but I know I'm definitely in for the 3 games that I wanted, which made me pretty happy.
Very good. Very good. So all we have to talk about now is the contests, or the contest currently. And yeah, you stole my thunder about talking about working for the state, so I don't have any Jonathan J. Reinhardt jokes associated with the contest today. However, so for folks interested, actually, look, I now have, I don't even know how many copies I have, about 15 copies of Field of Cards. So I'm going to open this contest up. Anyone who emails me with, like, Field of Cards contest, you're going to get a copy of Field of Cards. It's just as simple as that. This whole contest thing, political compass, clearly too cognitively intense for a majority of our listeners. Henry Hyde, I'm looking at you.
Ooh,
so
called out.
Email me, tom@nobleape.com. Really, you can message me through Facebook. People have done that as well. I've just got ludicrous copies willing to give away to anyone who listens to this very podcast, with a view that there are 13 typographical errors in this copy, but that will no doubt make it more valuable in the future. So normally it was associated with the political compass, but Jonathan's various political persuasions, all those kind of humour elements, just thrown out the window now. Just anyone who emails in, and I don't know, when I receive 15 emails, I'm going to close the contest. When I receive the number of emails associated with the number of copies I have, the contest will be closed. Until then, we'll just keep promoting the contest. So, well, we've got a fair number of folk that listen to us now, don't we, Jonathan?
We do, actually. I was pleasantly surprised, I should say. Everyone was very pleasantly surprised when I checked today to see what was going on. We use Feedburner to keep track of stats and stuff for the podcast, and I was just very pleasantly surprised when I went ahead and I checked, and I'm actually checking right now to see what the number is at. But episode 51, which was our then most recent episode as of, you know, the time of releasing, had 85 downloads, which makes it our second most popular episode. Right after the interview with Bill Detmers, which has about 100 downloads right there. So
yeah.
I
figure when we have the new... I mean, my understanding, and this, again, is temporal, because no doubt there'll be at least two digital episodes after the fact. But as we're recording, the Neil Shook episode will be the episode that will go in the feed next week. And my assumption is...
That's going to
because
Neil...
It. Yeah, Neil is not... Neil's not been interviewed at all previously, to my knowledge. And my feeling is that's probably going to get a few downloads, I'd hope.
I'm going to predict that the Neil Shook episode breaks 100 downloads and pushes the episode with Bill Detmers of 127games.com into the number 2 slot.
I'm hopeful too. I know Neil's ready to post on his blog any second that show goes online, because I think... The sad thing was that I had a lot more questions for Neil, but just in terms of time, I mean, I was literally talking to him at 3 or 4 in the morning his time, and I just felt really bad for him. So I had to actually cut that short. I have probably another 2 shows worth of questions for Neil. My hope is we'll get him on the next episode. We'll do a force-on-force comparison review, potentially talk about a wide variety of other things, because really... I've known Neil through his podcasts for, I guess, 3-4 years now, and also through correspondence, because I helped him out very early on with audio issues. But I really like Neil. I think I've got a lot of time for his stuff. I think he's exactly on point with a lot of stuff, slightly off point with other things. But in terms of just listening to someone for about 4 years, I have at least 4 years' worth of questions with Neil, which my hope is I can concatenate into 2 future follow-up interviews, because really we only skimmed the surface in that one. But we did cover a lot of material, and it was funny. I went and checked the White Dwarf's following, and I was right. But it's only because I'm mildly autistic with regards to these kind of things. But anyway, no, it was wonderful to have Neil on. My hope is that sometime, because obviously Henry's tied up doing rules... But when Henry gets off the rules, that he and I, and potentially you as well, will be able to get together for a similar kind of grilling, actually. I've got a lot of questions for Henry. In fact, I need to do way more research before I talk to Henry than I did with Neil. Neil, I pretty well ad-libbed it. I had some basic sketches. But Henry is so academic with regards to his knowledge, particularly of the history of certain aspects of the hobby and various people and these kind of things, that I will need to be on my toes before I even consider talking to Henry. But that will be coming up sometime in the foreseeable future. And I'd also like to get some additional people on. I think there are a wide variety of folk in the kind of broader community who would make very interesting guests on this particular podcast. And, yeah, once we kind of, you know, get in a few people, I mean, we've had Stephen, obviously, we're certainly setting the bar high, and I think Neil Shook one should set it pretty high, and then we'll just keep on moving from there. But I had a great deal of fun talking with Neil. It's always a pleasure. I mean, literally before recording this podcast, he was online. I was typing to him, trying to encourage him to be on this very show. But yeah, potentially in the future we'll get Neil on to even co-host some shows, which would be really nice.
That'd be fantastic.
Well, anyway, Jonathan, your rabbits were having a party in the background for a period of time in this evening's recording, but it all has gone quiet on the Massachusetts front in that regard. So I'm not sure whether they've just given up and gone to bed or, what's going on in your part of the world. But I should probably let you go. It's been an absolute pleasure as always, Jonathan, and next week we will, well, it may not be next week as people listen to this, we will have a lot more material. What are you seeing coming up in your part of the world, aside from obviously Azarkon and this Battlegrounds Games and Hobbies stuff? Are you, in terms of other folk that you want to talk to, who else is on your list?
Well, I'm actually going to be talking in the next episode, I hope the next episode, I'm going to be talking about a zombie game that uses
Ooh.
Necromunda rules.
I
will have...
You mentioned this previously, yeah. You mentioned that in the last episode.
We're recording this on... And I shouldn't put any time dates in this, because, you know, that dates things fast. But
January 4th, we're recording.
Exactly. 2002. So we're recording this two nights before the big zombie fight night. It's run twice a year, and so I will be... I don't know if I'm actually playing it. I can't stay very late. It usually runs until like 2 or 3 in the morning is what it is.
It's right,
like
yeah,
6.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm going to be there recording it, taking notes and stuff. And I'll be talking about it, but it's a great event. And that's something I'm looking forward to talk about. And actually, the guy who runs it, I'd love to get on our show, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. Mainly because he's a whiz with terrain. He's really into Flames of War. He's the only guy I know who plays commies for Flames of War. And he's just into all sorts of stuff. He made great 3D islands for the Wizards of the Coast War at Sea, and he used to play the old WizKids CC, I don't even know if you call it CCG, a collectible minigame, but the Pirates game, and that kind of stuff. So he has all sorts of classic GW stuff. He goes back to Rogue Trader, fantastic stuff. So he would be very interesting to talk to, but he's very, very busy. He has a little one, and... He's a kitchen manager at a restaurant near to him, so I know that keeps him very busy as well.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, he has to find the time to assemble some Flames of War stuff for me so I can paint it and actually start playing. So.
Ooh. You have a business relationship with this man. Very
yeah,
good.
There
very
we go.
Good.
But, I mean, there's some people.
Sorry? You dropped off there, Jonathan.
No, just he's one of the people I want to talk to. And I mean, of course, there's others. I actually have a whole interview I did with my friend Drew that has never been released. So that's going to be appearing sometime in the near future. And as you mentioned...
So what's happened with his podcast? Does he need another person to co-host?
He does, actually. And I've been talking to him about it. I told him as long as I don't have to do the editing, and as long as we don't make it more than an hour, I can go on and I'll guest host her as long as he needs it.
Does he need any information on deceased estates? Is this something that I could step in for at least an episode?
Do you know what? He very well could.
He's also an orc player as well, which is an additional thing that we could certainly talk about.
He's into space orcs. He's trying to become an accountant. He's a very, very smart numbers kind of guy. And it never ceased to amaze him when I was a public official and the fact that, you know, I basically had to oversee millions and millions and millions of dollars and I'm not a numbers guy. Thankfully, the people who double-checked everything were numbers people, but he used to just find that very funny for some reason, so I don't know.
I don't find that funny. But anyway, I don't even live in your jurisdiction. I mean,
hey, it's the voters. That's all I got to say.
Very good. Well, we probably should wrap it up, Jonathan. We've been riffing. I mean, this whole show has just been a riff show, sponsored in part by... What would Pan do news from the front? The people to talk to about your deceased estate. So, yeah, it's just been a riffing show. We'll have some serious content next week. We promise, folks. We promise.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure as always, Jonathan. Have a great evening.
You
Good
too.
Night.
Warning. Warning. Coming up next is the Music to Game By segment in the CWF Gamecast. Please stay tuned. We'll be back after this song. We'll be right back.
You say, Major, what on earth are you doing?
It's this blooming issue of Battle Games. It appears to be wearing some kind of futuristic armor. Pass me the can opener so I can try to get it out.
No, no, Major. That is an iPad.
Good Lord, man, don't be daft. It'll never fit under me monocle.
No, Major. The iPad is just another device you can use to read Battle Games magazine, because it's available in digital form as well as on paper.
Digital? What's that? A magazine with fingers? Well, there's still too much newfangled stuff in here. All these tanks and Blitzkrieg Commander and plastic now. They seem to be condoning the replacement of good old-fashioned lead. This is outrageous.
Yes, but there's still plenty of good old-school content as well, like command challenges and even a smattering of Spencer Smith's, what?
Yes, true, and those maps are first-rate. And I've read some excellent book reviews, and articles comparing rule sets, and how to make things, and interviews with some jolly interesting chaps. Well, I've got to admit, I've been converted, so get me a pigeon, I need to place an order.
Converted? Excellent, Major. Committed, more like.
Come and visit the website at www.battlegames.co.uk, where you can find the magazine on paper for instant digital download or even on CD, so you can simply choose whatever suits you best. You could be downloading and reading your very first issue of Battle Games in just a matter of minutes, so why not give it a try? Battle Games, the spirit of wargaming.
The CWF Gamecast is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Axis and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com. And contest sponsor, Battle Games Magazine, the spirit of wargaming, available at fine hobby shops throughout the United Kingdom and beyond. Subscribe online at www.battlegames.co.uk. This recording is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. Look for the CWF Gamecast online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.